Welcome back. We're here with another excellent episode of The Geek Whispers. I'm Amy Lewis.
I'm Matt Brender.
And I'm John Mark Troyer.
And we have a very special guest from the security community with us here. How to even introduce you? I guess we'll say your actual name, but I feel like people know you in many ways. So we have Christopher Hoff on the line with us. Preference, do people just yell out Hoff, Beaker? How do people refer to you?
Yeah, it depends on the context. So if they actually meet me in the physical world, oftentimes they don't actually know my name besides Beaker. They're like, are you Beaker? I'm like, oh, God, what did I do to you? Everyone just calls me Hoff or Beaker, apparently. So my wife calls me something else, but that's it.
Well, welcome to the show. We are thrilled to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
So, here to talk about your career path, and we'd love to kick things off and say, okay, are you one of those planners? Did you know when you were a kid you were going to wind up here? Where are you in your career path?
Have you seen Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension?
I have.
Okay, I'm not going to make a John Big Boudet reference, but more specifically, there's a quote from that film that says something on the order of, no matter where you go, there you are. So I am here, and where here is I work for Juniper Networks as a security CTO. Relative to the question about did I ever plan, think, I can't believe you actually asked me that question. Like, I am the antithesis of planning. And in fact, the arrival into this career was, I don't want to say accidental, but just kind of one big Zen fluid. Okay, that sounds interesting and exciting. I'll just keep doing that. And it sort of just evolved. I think there's a whole generation of folks that work in the security industry, and they're coming for me. You can hear the sirens. That work in the security industry now that just really got lucky in terms of timing. Mostly around the emergence of the internet and what it meant to kind of security in general, how important it became. And that's the same with me. It just kind of happened.
So, but when you started out in IT, let's go back even further then. So obviously you in some ways didn't know you were going to be here when you got started. But has security always been what brought you into technology, or what kind of brought you into technology overall?
So insecurity brought me into technology, and you can that's a play on words in many ways. So it, like many in the generation I referred to, when computers became a thing, especially as it became widespread in the kind of 80s and 90s, and the internet came into being as a kind of a commercial interest, and you could get both mainstream access through services, but also we'll just call it non-mainstream access. There's a whole generation of folks that have grown up as hackers, and I mean that not in the criminal. I think if I say cyber, Amy has to drink, so I'm going to say it lots of times. But in that sense, a lot of us came up kind of in the IRC and BBS worlds, bulletin board system worlds, dial up, and then the internet happened, and there was a kind of merging there. There's telephone system experimentation, all sorts of interesting stuff with software. And so I kind of stumbled into, I had computers as a hobby, and I grew up in New Zealand on a sheep farm in an iron sand mining community, which is about the most distance you could possibly compute linearly from a career in where I am today.
That's practically like Silicon Valley. So,
oh yeah, I mean, it's exactly, yeah. Well, lots of sheep for sure. And the interesting thing is with my social studies teacher, somehow, I don't understand how it happened, but we got an Apple, one of the original Apple IIs in this lab, actually. And then we had two, and then we had three of them. And I had no idea what to do. So there was a really super, super smart kid who knew his way around these machines, and I would just quite literally peer over his shoulder and replicate whatever he typed. I had no idea what I was doing. And then I stole a manual, took it home with me when I was a kid, and just kind of read it. And that just launched this whole notion of experimentation. And so if you want to classify IT in general, in my experience in that regard, I got into through a meandering path, a career in classical IT by essentially doing kind of system administration and network administration. And then when the internet came online, we had to kind of secure that stuff as you connected to external entities. And it just became something that I was able to take from my prior days of experimentation and on the one hand, and map it to something that I just kind of fell in love with. So it, and a lot of folks that are in security today came from that very mixed bag, dare I say, DevOps-y like background where you did everything. You were a system administrator, you were a network administrator, you were a security person. You helped bring the applications online or even help write them. So it just happened. And again, it goes back into a bit of luck and timing. So
that is really interesting. So because we've heard a lot of different stories on here, and Matt, John, if you want to hop in, the security story sounds a little bit different, but what you're saying is you have found that within the security community that is a fairly typical path.
Oh yeah. Most people my age, kind of in their 40s, that are kind of at a level where you're kind of CTO or you're a chief information security officer. I'd say a good majority of them, at least the ones I know in the security community and even the security industry, have taken a very similar path coming from that kind of that background. And, you know, for me, the thing that drove me into security proper, almost as a specialization, if you want to call it that, or a career choice, actually happened on the first couple of days in college. I just actually chronicled this on Facebook, where I was in a computer lab and all of a sudden I noticed weird things starting to happen to people's screens around me. Like the guy to my left, his screen literally started to kind of melt, like look like acid. The one next to him, his X windows started to rotate, and his head, as he would continue to type, and his head would just turn at the same angle that the window would turn. The other one grew feet and walked off the screen. And there was a guy sitting in the corner who was just giggling like a 12-year-old school kid. And it turns out that he was running all sorts of, you know, funny things on these workstations, making bizarre things. Ended up having root on almost every single platform in UC Berkeley. And I won't tell you what happened next because it's not G-rated. But at about the time the dean walked in with a tour,
oh Lord,
things appeared on the screen that shouldn't have. Anyway, that guy, I got so flustered and excited. I said, "How did you do that?" And he pointed me to the manual and said, "Go figure it out yourself."
Oh wow! So it started with mischief.
Yeah, well, that's the whole point. So all of that kind of the stuff I was talking about as a hobby and experimentation and telephone systems and all the things you hear about, and hacking and BBSs in the good old days before we had the CFAA and hacking was a bad thing. It literally was just, you know, total curious, insane, obsessive behavior about reverse engineering things, anything, physical, doesn't really matter. So, like I said, most of the folks that I know in this industry that are kind of very active and are in leadership roles have come from that background.
Well, Amy, that's interesting. In parallel to our other people we've talked to, right, this curiosity definitely stands out. People who are tinkerers, people who keep learning. So I think that's, Hoff, I think you're in common with a lot of the other people we've talked with, and most interesting people are. So you talked about when you got interested in hacking, but and reverse engineering and how things worked, the modern equivalent of taking apart, radios and clocks.
Yeah.
But what was the point where you actually went from an IT person and decided to become a specialist professionally? Because I've been talking to a lot of people about developing specialties and how one does that, and it's different for everybody. But I don't know, was there a particular moment or a particular gig?
Yeah, there was. I worked for a company called Shiat Day Advertising, which was a really amazing company that covered actually the first ad agency for Apple and I think even Nike and Reebok, and just they were just an amazing creative place who invested tremendously in technology. And my job was to take care of the networks there. We were kind of ahead of our time relative to pushing the limits of what Apple's could do, because it was basically an all Apple environment back in the early 90s. And we connected very early to the internet, and there was a CCMail gateway that we used for email, and we launched and started playing with things like Waze and Gopher, and when Netscape Navigator first came online, and you had Mosaic more specifically, and the folks that ran Chai Day just totally got that this was going to change everything, and so they pushed us headlong into connecting to everything and anything and associating and putting a brand online. And people like me were equally as interested in exploring the resources that were made available to them. And so when we started connecting to the internet proper, besides things like email, we then had to kind of think about how we were going to start preventing bad things from happening vis-a-vis people, you know, accessing those same systems that weren't supposed to. So I went from being the network guy to the network and security guy. And ultimately, I just gained so much knowledge in that phase that I joined my first startup shortly thereafter, about a year and a half after being there, that was building a remote access server for allowing access across either the internet or dial-up lines to those resources. And it just went from there. Security just became this thing that continued to show up as a set of skills that I had that a lot of other people didn't. And it just kind of, I mean, networking has always been there as the conduit and the method by which most security is deployed anyway. And so ultimately after going there, I got hired by another company and deployed a globally managed security service on, 152 countries and four continents that just put firewalls and managed firewalls for companies. Wow. And so it just kind of exploded. I mean, it just went from there. Just hey, I Hoff. Couldn't escape at that point.
Oh, sorry. Yep. Hey, Hoff, I've got to just kind of tag Amy in and say it sounds a lot like advice that you give often, Amy, that you start specializing by going towards the job that you want, and lo and behold, it becomes the job.
Actually, just my other question was, it's interesting you're talking about people your age who hit a certain level, pure seat time and experience. What do you see for folks who are, or is it common? Do people transfer in? Are people on other IT paths and become interested later? Do you see a lot of people transferring in and out, or does it tend to be a tighter, more focused community? And what about the kids these days? How are people getting into it now?
Yeah, I brought up that notion of kind of parallels to DevOps, right? Earlier in the conversation, it's funny, I gave a talk and one of the venues I had to give that talk to was at Microsoft at their internal security conference. And I had to give a preview to a bunch of executives there. I didn't know who they were, but we were talking about stuff, and I have this one slide that talks about the challenges of skill sets, as well as kind of the need to change how we operationalize security and who does it and who's responsible for it. My wife was on her way before I married her and knocked her up to becoming a PhD in planetary geophysics. And so she did all of her postdoc work on this meteorite impact in the Chicxulub crater that killed the dinosaurs. And I said, look, the interesting thing about our industry and our community is that what we actually desperately need to get out of this rut is a KT level extinction event for, old dinosaurs like us. Because the funny thing is, we all started from this mixed mode culture of doing everything. And what you have now with the folks that have, budgets and lead teams, and, we're very kind of just stuck in our ways about how security ought to be operationalized, that the very same type of behaviors and people that a lot of chief information security officers and the security community in general kind of yell to get off their lawn are doing the exact same things that we used to do when we came up. And so, when I was walking out, somebody asked this guy who, very influential guy, it turns out, what do you think about the presentation? I heard him mumbling under his breath. He said, I think that guy called me a bleep in dinosaur, which was actually kind of funny. So relative to your actual question, there are so many interesting bits of the fragmented and fractured security industry and community in terms of roles that people have become either very generalized or incredibly specialized. And so depending upon kind of your skill set, a lot of folks are transferring in or starting their careers as incident responders, as folks that have specific skill sets, mostly oriented around kind of a programming background. So they can do things like malware research. They can do incident response because they actually disassemble and reverse engineer code to kind of understand how attacks have propagated. Whereas others can be more generic and just kind of take off-the-shelf software and understand how it's integrated and understand sort of the language and nuance of implementing security controls at various different levels. So there's a high degree of segmentation and fractured career paths in security. And it's just so fractured that you have an interesting way of kind of getting your foot in the door. But because it's fractured, it's hard to figure out what your career path is if you stay specialized. So it's an interesting question. And so when people say, you know, what should I do? How do I get in the quote industry? I'm like, which part of the industry? Like, what are your expectations? So, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? So, and a lot of people don't know, and I didn't know, which is why I laughed when you asked me the question about, you know, are you surprised that you got here? It's like, I didn't even know where here was.
So. I think that's inspiring.
Or confusing, or just at least honest, but either way, it is what it is.
For folks just starting out, is there a danger that the screws have been tightened a little bit too much? I mean, some of the stuff that people did back in the day would get them thrown in jail these days.
Oh, very much so. I mean, yeah, the interesting thing, if you look at cyber, if you look at, for example, some of what the government is trying to do, they can't recruit people fast enough and they can't pay them enough compared to the private sector. But one of the things they're even doing is, like, you saw, I think it was I believe it was the FBI who said, look, if you happen to have just, you know, it's like, don't ask, don't tell. If you happen to have like done stuff in the past, we won't really hold that against you. Kind of winky, winky, because they need the skill sets. They actually need people. Like, if you're going to be able to defend against adversaries that have unlimited budgets, unlimited time, and unlimited resources, and you don't understand the context around how attacks are actually implemented, you can't effectively defend against them. So the skill sets of people today, in some cases, especially with what you're seeing with, you know, when President Obama comes to Stanford and starts talking about how important security is to the world and cyber, and it's critical. And now it's mainstream and you see television shows like Scorpion and CSI Cyber and, you know, Hacker the movie. It's really kind of gone beyond this weird IT, the guy in the corner, you know, in the dark room, or Milton from Office Space. It's really a board level discussion today. Security, information security, cybersecurity is like tremendously important. And so, you know, the thing is that in many cases, yes, you can, and you see people being prosecuted and thrown in jail for the weirdest things that certainly one could argue don't really make sense in the context of which, you know, an event occurred because of the way laws are written today. And some of them were written in the 80s and they're really just not applicable to, or they need to be rewritten. But, you know, that's a challenge, right? Is you've got a bunch of folks who work in the public sector or DOD or Intel, and the government space is very different than the private sector. The private sector, in many ways, you know, while you have more kind of, you could say in some cases, freedom to do some things, you also don't have some of the same capabilities as the public sector, government, DOD, Intel does. It's a fascinating kind of spectrum.
Well, in fact, often Quinn Norton, a journalist, actually just said she was getting out of security journalism because she was afraid she was going to be shown files with credit cards and personally identifiable information and potentially be liable for that.
Yeah, I mean, it goes beyond just liability from a legal perspective. You see just how insane, whether it's Gamergate, whether, you know, any of these things where, you know, anonymous, you have a tremendous amount of exposure. And, you know, Quinn documented the fact that she just didn't feel safe or obligated to put herself at risk by even just being a conduit describing or having seen some of this stuff, right? You kind of become a party to things that are later potentially you can be indicted for. So yeah, it's a very slippery slope. And so, you know, relative to the, your appetite for risk, the kind of the path you choose will come with some pretty interesting strings sometimes.
Leads me into my next question, and love to hear your thoughts about this. Ironically, when you talk about that level of liability and your risk tolerance, one of the things you're really well known for is presentations. So even though you're in this industry where it carries this weight of, you know, future potential indictment, just like you were mentioning the presentation you gave to a number of higher ups, you're called on a lot to do that. I've got a number of questions there. So how do you go about creating a presentation that's both satisfying, engages your audience, maybe calls your audience some names, engaging and not going to get you thrown in jail?
Yeah, I mean, most of what I present about is sort of disruptive stuff that's coming down the pike. And I don't really focus on doing research that exposes zero-day vulnerabilities and or would drop people in hot water. So I kind of escape some of that by virtue of the things I talk about, which is kind of one way of looking at it. But most people ask me, especially given just how, I don't know, intense. I speak rather quickly. Most of my presentations are very graphic, not in a bad way, but graphical.
Avert your eyes.
That's right. Well, actually, that happens all the time anyway. But the funny thing is like, oh, how did you, you know, I could give the most engaging, awesome presentation. I'd be like, time for Q&A, if there ever is, because I take like every breath and microsecond is available to me. Somebody says, the only question I ever get is, hey, what did you use to build your presentation? I'm like, seriously? That's what you want to know about? All right. So interestingly, most of my presentations, right, I don't do on behalf of my employer. I do them because I have passion and interest in a particular field. But when people say, for example, like if you look at some of the titles of my talks, like the Four Horsemen of the Virtualization Security Apocalypse or Cloud of Fornication, Indiscriminate Information Intercourse Involving Internet Infrastructure, or the Seven Dirty Words of Cloud Security, or, you know, My Cloud Evangelist Says Just Not to a CSO, or, you know, it, or there's a whole bunch, or Commode Computing, which is a history of toiletry and waste management in IT. People say like, oh, you know, how'd you come up with that, the idea and the context? Well, what's really funny is I'll just get an idea, usually around a topic, maybe, or I will see a graphic, just an image that is interesting to me, and I'll kind of go about my life. I'll be in the shower or whatever, or I'll wake up one night. And the next thing that happens is I'll take that word or that graphic image, and I will go find or build literally a keynote, which is the app I use on the Mac to author these things, a template. And I will then build this, you know, all of the template screens and the graphics, and it'll be literally hinged off of this one image. And then I'll go find a bunch of other images. And once I've got the images and the graphics, then I actually go and find and map the topic and the points I want to discuss around the,
I love it.
It has absolutely, like, I have, like, I don't say, oh, I want to go talk about, so the Four Horsemen, right? This is the kind of my presentation where I got launched. I gave it, Black Hat is the kind of biggest security conference kind of on the planet. And that was the first time I ever got to present on that size of a stage with that audience. And I was totally nervous. But the Four Horsemen of the Virtualization Security Apocalypse came about because I saw this amazing graphic about the Four Horsemen, the fable from the Bible. I happened to say, oh, well, I got to talk about something technical. What am I interested in? Oh, virtualization. Yeah, okay, I'll do that. So it's completely nonsensical, which probably explains why there's a bunch of interesting, rambly kind of things that I string together with stories and thematics, that I always pick a thematic that goes up front hinged on that image, and I tie it back to the message that I want at the kind of at the end, the point I want to take away from. But it is completely nonsensical. When I describe this to people, they're like, I don't believe you, or that makes no sense. But I don't know, 30, 40, 50 presentations that have been given to, at this point, hundreds of thousands of people later, I guess somebody likes it. So it doesn't make any sense to me either, but it just is the way it is.
Oftentimes when technologists give presentations to non-technologists, whether they be executives or business people or whatever, there's kind of a disconnect in language. It sounds like one of the things you try to do is bridge it by telling stories. But are there any other – do you consciously do that, or are there any other techniques that you use to make your presentations relatable?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a story. And And I always try to, like I said, I try to pick that one thematic thing. Like the latest talk, it was very funny. I got a call from a friend of mine who said, will you come and give a talk at this conference? And he and I both train in martial arts. And he said, and make it like jujitsu themed. I'm like, yeah, okay, fine, whatever. So that was my thing, right? I had an image. I go pick the image. I built the template. And I'm like, okay, what the hell am I going to talk about? So I had no, it just turns out that then one day after I wrote the whole presentation, the thematic and the content, I went and looked on the website, and it turns out the entire conference is martial arts themed. So the first, you know, I have a 30-minute talk. The first 10 minutes was the history of mixed martial arts and the UFC and jiu-jitsu and how I kind of showed videos and the evolution. I mean, there's lots of topics going on in that talk about the evolution of mixed martial arts mapped to the evolution of security, as well as ultimately what that means in terms of how we actually operationalize security from being almost passive and purely defensive to be more active and in some cases potentially offensive. But it all kind of stemmed around this, you know, 3D fight through the timeline related to the history of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu up to mixed martial arts in the UFC. And it just, what I get out of that is, even if you're not a technologist, you will learn something about mixed martial arts in the UFC, even if you turn off for the rest of the security stuff. But 9 times out of 10, what I get is, you had me at hello. I was really interested. You told me about something I had no idea about in the first place. That was not what I was expecting. And then you kind of connected it to what would otherwise be kind of boring and nerdy. But because of the way that you take right brain and left brain stuff and are able to smush them together, I find it just sticks with people. And they it's a bit of, I call it, it's infotainment to me. It's not as deep and technical as some of my peers, but at the same point in time, that's not what I'm aiming for. So,
well, and I would just want to jump in here. A couple observations. Would love to hear your thoughts on if people are interested in being presenters and speakers, kind of what you did to get started. Because I think once you are started, demand creates demand.
Okay, so let me tell you, I'm going to start. First of all, I am absolutely, and I nobody believes it, I'm absolutely terrified of and this will not make any sense, but I am the world's biggest introvert. I hate being in crowds. I hate presenting. I hate speaking. I hate feeling like I'm judged and being like stared at. And so I always tell the story when I was at a company, they had a Toastmasters Club, you know, and I was so terrified and bad at it that I joined Toastmasters. And Toastmasters has this thing called, tabletops. You have like 2 minutes that you pick a random topic out of a hat or a jar, and you have to speak for 2 minutes. And if you know anything about Toastmasters, you get dinged for every time you use a filler word, and you have to really be able to think on your feet about how you construct what it is you're talking about, even if you have no idea what you're talking about, which is perfect because 9 times out of 10 I don't. So I pick out this topic, I forget what it was, and about 30 seconds into staring at these empty faces, just, you know, looking back at me, I honest to God faked an aneurysm. I went, and it must have worked because they were about to call the paramedics. So I run I never went back. It was just horrifying to me. But what it
you could
did
have
was,
coughed, but
no. Oh, I just kind of went and held my breath, so I like turned purple and the veins popped out of my head, and then went grabbed my left eye and ran out like I was gonna die. And so the funny part about that was I felt so bad and embarrassed because everyone thought I had an aneurysm. That was kind of funny that I could pull that off. But I wanted to reverse engineer like why I felt that way. Now, one thing you have to realize is besides growing up on a sheep farm in an iron sand community in New Zealand, my mother actually worked in the city, and she was an actress, and she ended up becoming kind of a famous actress in the soap opera world in Australia and New Zealand. So I was around actors and actresses my whole life, this whole flair for dramatic, which is, I think, how I pulled off this aneurysm bit, right? Perfect training. I don't know if there's a classical course for aneurysms, but if there is, I should probably take one. But I wanted to kind of reverse engineer, like, okay, look, I don't want to ever do that again. That really sucked. How can I feel better and more confident in doing this? And so by creating presentations in my own terms, by relating them to stories and things that I was interested in and passionate about, and things that were interesting to me, like stories, like Aesop's Fables, or topics at hand or things that a lot of people didn't know about. So, you know, things that are emerging and disruptive, you can paint your own picture, right? You can have opinions. Like, nobody can ever tell you that your opinion is wrong. They can disagree with you. They can counter and suggest that they have a different opinion, but with disruption and innovation and emerging stuff, you can't tell me I'm wrong, which got me over the hump of feeling judged. And so when I start talking about stuff that's, you know, future tense, it's really kind of a cop out. It lets me catch up with the present tense so I can actually be decently confident about what I actually am supposed to know. But it's an interesting balance. And I think, you know, when people want to go present, what they do is they pick something that is like in the present tense and they feel uncertain and quote insecure. That's why I used that word before about whether or not they have the credibility or confidence to speak about it. When you pick stuff that's new, nobody knows it. So, it gives you the comfort and the capability to go talk about interesting things. So I think that's about the most obtuse but realistic answer to what I tell people about presenting. Just find something that you love. You don't even have to be an expert in it, but just find something that you are just totally interested in. And the rest just comes naturally. You don't have to be a great presenter. What you have to convince an audience of is that you have something interesting to say because it is meaningful to you.
And this ties into the other question, although, you ruined my perfectly good guess. Right. I was going to say, you made me think of when people talk about blogging and having a germ of an idea, and it's often an unusual side tangent, not the main point that one gets to, if you will. And it sounds in some ways that's similar. Or I think about actually the songwriters that I know when you described how you develop presentations. But it strikes me as presentations for you almost are what blogs or songs are to other people. It sounds like your most preferred format. So it's hilarious that reverse engineers to a tale about faking an aneurysm. So it seems unlikely it would be your format of choice, but I'm starting to think you like to take on the big challenges, the martial arts, the presentations.
Yeah. I mean, I love it when people tell me I can't do something. Mm. That's probably the worst thing you want to ever say to me if you expect me to shut up. So, blogging is very interesting and social media is very interesting because frankly, blogging and long form stuff has taken a backseat, even for me, to kind of very snippy 140 character blurbs on Twitter. And actually, for me, Twitter requires actually way more thought than blogging ever does. Like blogging, I can just go blah, and then go edit it, right? If you want to be impactful in 140 characters, you have to like squeeze and condense this thing down and you have to think about, some people don't. And in many cases, I don't either. But if I really want to make a point, besides the 140 character limit, you have to think about how people are going to react to that. You either going to be totally obtuse or incredibly pointed, and you have to understand what's going to happen when people start interacting around those memes. And the interesting thing is, like for me, the most amount of interaction I get in a long form blog is when I keep it super short. And even if I have every conclusion and point that I ever want to make in a blog, and I already know the answer to the question I'm asking, if you write that out in long form, first of all, TL semicolon DR, nobody reads it anyway, and they won't bother interacting because they don't actually want to disagree with a well thought out point. If you just say, here's an idea, I don't really have a conclusion, people will light that thing up with 6,000 comments because they feel free and empowered to actually add their own conclusions. So it's sort of funny, right? The mediums allow you to experiment with ways in which you communicate with people, and people either love you or hate you based on, how they prefer to communicate. So it's very interesting to me.
I love that. And I totally agree with you. I think short form copy is more challenging. It is poetry to novels. Yes, it is difficult to compose a lot, but short form is challenging. And I also love the concept of leaving it open.
I also like the way it highlights Hoff's point on experimentation. I think we all kind of indulge ourselves in the playfulness of Twitter, and you get to hash an idea out and, worst case scenario, it goes unseen. No one really cares. But sometimes you can really, it sounds like Hoff, like you really refined your your art of the Twitter foo, if you will, where like you can get you know how to get people's attention if you want to, and that shines through in your presentations. It shines through in like how you choose to format a blog post. It seems like you've really got the social understood about how people either engage or disengage. I find that fascinating. Yeah.
Well, know. But the next time Hoff zings me on Twitter, I'm going to fake an aneurysm, though. Just go on record.
I mean, it's really not as deliberate and calculated as I actually made it seem to be, right?
No,
I
just, it's always more detailed online.
it's just a funny, like, I love Twitter. It was a complete, I don't know, it's weird. My family, the Hoffspring, as they call them, you know, they always laugh because they will find themselves, and they now ask me the question. They're like, you know, did you just invite Twitter over to the barbecue again? Or, you know, the people and relationships that I've made, and whether I never meet somebody in real life or not, that medium has provided me with such an amazing, you know, set of resources by which I can quickly poll and get an answer to pretty much anything. It's just astounding to me, and it's amazing to look at how you know, like InfoSec Taylor Swift, right? That's exactly the kind of point I'm making. You can start with an intent to just kind of be entertaining and snarky and funny, and then all of a sudden you find yourself with 50,000 followers, and people don't know whether it's real or not. And I kind of like that, right? Where I can hide between just being a, you know, as I often refer to myself, and I honestly do this, just an a-hole with a blog, or sometimes I'll use it and, you know, swing my band hammer, and you know, it's just fascinating.
I have to ask, and I'm dying to know if other people ask this, but I'm betting. So
boxers. Oh, I'm just kidding.
I would have bet money on briefs. Damn it.
how did you know our secret Geek Whispers question? No, I was, do people come up and ask you, hey man, how'd you get so many followers? You know, I want to get a bunch of followers. How do I get people to follow me? How do I get to be as influential as you?
No, because, you know, frankly, I think one of the things that that allows me to stay out of trouble is it's not really something I think about, right? It just is, and it's just happened. Same as my job, the first question, since this is the last one you guys have kind of, as we wrap up, right? I never planned for any of this. So for me, it may be hard to believe, but, you know, I'm sort of bashful, and I don't like sort of that attention where if you ask me how many followers I had, frankly, the only reason I knew is one day I stared at my profile and went, oh, Jesus.
and so, then you had an aneurysm.
But I'm the wrong person to ask. I'm like, well, one day in 2007, I logged on and I think I took a picture of lunch. And here we are. And I mean, that's about as accurate as I can be. I'm the worst person to ask for advice on careers, worst person to ask for advice on presentations, worst person to ask for advice on social media, because it just is. I don't know. Other people are far more, you know, professional and polished and better about those things and have 5-year plans. I'm just not one of those people.
But isn't that wonderful, Hoff? I mean, I think we've talked extensively with people that like to plan things out or had strategies. And I'll be honest and say I'm an obsessive over planner when given the room to do so for apparently no real reason. because you can get to fantastic, amazing results without doing that if you just follow some principles. It seems like principles are what drive you less than timeline.
They do the work. I'm going to jump in here and say the other sort of characteristic we're seeing, John called it out earlier, curiosity. And the other thing, Hoff, you've said repeatedly is you do the damn work. Because some of what gets frustrating is when people, it is the whole, they want the diet pill of influence or the diet pill of something else, you know? You don't do martial arts because it's easy. You don't do presentations because it was your first and, you know, easiest skill set. You did the work.
That's a great observation. I mean, and just to kind of cap that off, right, jiu-jitsu is a great example of that. I've been doing this for 8 years. I've broken, as you're well aware now, I'm laying in bed with a completely busted knee. I've broken everything in my body. It is the most brutal, agonizing, difficult, horrendously, amazingly awesome thing I've ever done. And, you know, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is, you know, it takes on average like 10 years to get a black belt. And it's so cerebral and so challenging and so demanding. And you just have to put in work. You have to put in mat time. And you have to want to continue to get to the level where even when you think you've reached a point that you've mastered something, you look back and you realize you're just beginning. And I mean, that's the way I look at things. It's the way I look at my career, my life, my family. You know, I'm turning 45 this year, and I look around and I'm like, oh man, are you kidding me? I just, you know, I was 25 like 10 minutes ago. but you know, I think Amy, I like the way you characterize that, because frankly, if you work hard at everything and anything you do, even if it amounts to nothing, what you end up with is a platform of experience and a you know, a diversity in experience that lets you just kind of be adaptive and allow you to do things that are unplanned. So I totally get, like, in people's DNAs, the you know, the over-conscientious planners, and they have things that I'm envious of, right? They have structure and they have a life that you think when you take a picture of it that, oh man, I wish I had that. At the same point in time, I've gone all over this world on other people's dimes. I get to talk to amazing people, you know, and I, you know, but I work like 16 hours a day, and I have a family that, you know, is, we're all totally intense in our own interests, and we all understand one another. But it wasn't planned, right? It just is. And that sounds very zen and weird, but it's not. I don't belong to any strange cults. But I think you're right. It's just about, you know, being passionate and putting in the work no matter what it is. And it doesn't matter whether it's, something for work or something for outside of work. I'm always 110% invested in whatever it is I do. So,
well, here's my other favorite question. So that's all the positive stuff. So if you could turn back time or stop someone and encourage them to make a new mistake, then what would be the one piece of advice, something you tell people, I did this, trust me, it was not a good idea, never ever do this again? What would you say?
I think there was that experience with this squid in South Korea.
Did the squid
win? Oh my God, did you eat the squid with the pouring?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
I just saw that on Facebook.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, that's why I commented. No,
I thought you tried a jiu-jitsu fight, like a killer octopus or something.
Yeah, no, that's not my Ahab story. No, it's worse. So in South Korea, I got invited by the government to go do this talk, and then they take you out to this dinner, and I was cool with the kimchi because that was pretty awesome. And there's like bulgogi and all the Americanized stuff. And then they're like, oh, let's get into some authentic Korean food. I'm like, yeah. And I had no idea that involved like taking small baby octopi and that you kind of stick your chopsticks in there and the thing wraps around and it's live. Mm-hmm. Around. You dunk it in, I don't know, sauce or whatever the hell. And then you literally stick it in your gourd and try to, you know, fight this thing down into, you know, your stomach. And meanwhile, it's squirting ink and it's trying to fight it. It's like the alien that's trying to like literally fight its way back out. So I'm like, well, okay. I don't know how you say hell no in Korean, but this is how you say it in not Korean. But so they're like, okay, look. So they let me drink a little bit more. And then they just kind of chopped off a tentacle. They said, well, you know, I don't know how you say wuss in Korean, but I'm sure that's what they were saying. They said, you try this. And I'm like, okay, well, how bad can that be? So I've never felt my food try to yeah, and it was just like, oh wow. So apparently there's about 10 people a year in Korea that die because it doesn't go down the way that people expect. So yeah, that would be I don't have anything more metaphysical than that. Just don't eat live squid.
I feel like we have a new section we need to add to the Geek Whispers, because we had Nick Weaver on and he and I had a shared balut experience that was also, I can't rank it as super positive.
No. My wife is, my wife's family is Filipino. Oh God. Yeah, no, balut. No,
read,
that's another.
Read the fine print. That's what I learned. Read the fine print.
Yeah.
Just an egg.
Just an egg.
I like eggs. Yeah. Famous last words.
Hey, Hoff, any advice for people coming up in terms of, I don't know, you know, looked at one through one lens, your your resume is very straightforward, right? You've got some big brand names on there, and Cisco and Unisys, et cetera. You know, looked at another way, you're kind of an unusual guy, and you've done some zigs and zags, I think. Any particular advice for how you're looking at people coming up, or any particular career advice for people who are kind of mid-career and looking to kind of either, you know, looking for the next step and may not fit in the org chart quite right?
Well, yeah, I mean, you all know this because you're involved in various ways with various communities. And I think the mistake people make is if they want to get invested in something, you can certainly be good at one thing and, you know, you do your job and that's fine. But I think, again, it relates to that passion and commitment. If you are able to get involved with the community, which is different than the industry, what you'll find is that you will gain relationships and you will gain insights and direction and assistance in ways that people that just do their job and, you know, want to kind of show up for a 9-to-5 never will. And so our community, IT, security in general, is so diverse, and there's so many ways you can get involved, volunteering for conferences, volunteering, showing up at meetups, just kind of, even if you don't like interacting with people so much, right? If you're an introvert, going and sitting in the back of the room and just listening to how people are communicating and getting in touch with the community is awesome, because you'll find, you know, there'll be that one magical moment or that person that just you're willing to invest time in, or they're willing to invest time in you, and, you know, amazing things can happen. So I think, you know, frankly, there's lots of, oh, you should go study this and technologically become interested in that. And, you know, I mean, Nick's a great example, right? I mean, he started, and if you track the trajectory of his career into where he is now, a lot of what he's known for is, you know, he gave back to and has presented a lot of information that has enabled and created tools and is known for, you know, a bunch of his social media activities and linking the two so that people feel that he's accessible. And there's tons of people like that. And so I think my advice is, don't get so wrapped up about or one dimensional about what you think about from a career perspective and how you break into or break out of a particular mold. I think you have to be able to be willing to get out of your comfort zone, fake an aneurysm now and then, but really get involved in the community in ways that you end up with these orthogonal or tangential kind of perspectives that you wouldn't gain otherwise. And that's the best advice I can give, because I know people that are way smarter, more brilliant and talented than me, but they just stay in a box, and maybe they're comfortable with that box, but some of them aren't. And they complain and they ask, like, what should I do? What can I do? And I'm like, dude, you have to interact with people in different ways than you are now. And some people do, and they take the advice, and some people don't. But I've seen a lot of folks that I've had that conversation with that just, I'm like, I look at them, I'm like, you know, that's my boy, that's my girl. Like, I can't remember the days when you used to do or didn't do this, and now look at you. And I mean, some of these people, you would be very surprised to know their names. And I'm not saying I had anything to do with their success, other than, like, just being open and vulnerable about the fact that, look, I'm not perfect. I make mistakes every single day, but I just try to learn from them.
Hey, I don't have a question so much as just a note on our undercurrent of a theme here, that you faking an aneurysm at that Toastmasters event. You know what I like is that our story of you speaking in public didn't stop there. It started there, and I don't want that point to go understated at all.
Yeah, you're right. It really pissed me off. It pissed me off that I was so cowardly that I did that, and I never wanted to feel. I wasn't embarrassed about the aneurysm. I wasn't embarrassed about the table topic. I was embarrassed about the fact that I didn't just stop and say, "Ugh, I don't know. I can't do. I suck. I'll do it again next week." Right? It just really bothered me. And yeah, so, you know, it's okay to fail, right? I mean, it's almost a cliche to say that now. I don't know. Maybe if somebody wants to write me a $50 million check, I'll be more than glad to fail on their account anytime anyway. But, you know, the reality is that I haven't had that luxury. But yeah, that's exactly right. I didn't stop, and neither should anybody else. Just because you make a mistake, it's not the end of the world.
Hard to top that as good advice. So Hoff, really, really appreciate you being on with us this week. For people who want to follow up, ask you more questions, where are some of the places they should look for you online?
If you dare. Twitter is at Beaker, B-E-A-K-E-R, as in the Muppet. I have a blog, but if you just Google at Beaker or my name, Chris Hoff, you can find the blog because it's a mouthful to pronounce. But I like Twitter. You can just always reach me on Twitter pretty much 24 hours a day. So,
excellent.
Unfortunately.
Well, heal fast. I know I admitted before the podcast started that I look for all my guests to be incapable of running from me, whatever. So appreciate that you're joining us as you recover. So,
and as I said in the beginning of the call, it's not like I had a choice. You just kept calling on Skype. So what am I going to do? I can't escape my bed. All right. So well played. Well played. I guess I could have faked an aneurysm, but not this time. Damn it.
All right. Well, until next time. So for all the listeners out there, thanks so much for your feedback and suggestions. Keep telling us who you would like to hear from. And if you like it, share it with a friend. Give us a thumbs up, some stars, etc. So that's shameless pandering. And until next time, Geek Whisperers out.
You've been listening to the Geek Whisperers podcast, where we bring social media and community to enterprise IT. You can listen to all the episodes at our website, geek-whisperers.com, or check us out on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. Your hosts were John Mark Troyer, Amy Lewis, and Matthew Brender, better known on Twitter as J. Troyer, Comms Ninja, and MJ Brender. See you next week.